Consider the word strong. Now consider how it might apply in the context of this program. You got it? All right, good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, somehow already the 1st of August. It's good to have you along, everybody. Look, I know this is radio, but bear with me here for a minute, would you? If you did one of those word cloud things of the first paragraph of the Federal Reserve's statement today, wrapping up its meeting on interest rates and the economy, the word in big bold type would be strong. Job gains have been strong. Investment is strong. The labor market is strong. And that's all just in the first paragraph. If it needs to be said, interest rates are staying right where they are for the time being because the Fed is nothing if not predictable. Next meeting is coming up at the end of September. While we're on the Fed, though, here is today's Marketplace shameless self-promotion moment. We had Chair Jay Powell on the program last month. We put the whole interview we did online, went about a half an hour. Marketplace.org is the website. Mentioned on air is the link to click. There is news from the Treasury Department moving on about financial technology, fintech as it's known, and innovation. Specifically, Treasury has decided it doesn't want regulation to get in the way of banks and startups selling fintech products to consumers. So this week, it issued new guidelines and recommendations for those regulators. As Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains, it sounds almost like child's play. Almost.
The Treasury Department wants to set up regulatory sandboxes where financial businesses and startups can play around, test out new ideas and products with less government oversight. Dara Tarkowski is a partner at Actuate Law in Chicago.
The regulators say, you know what, this may not fit into an existing scheme, but let's work side by side with you, give you limited access to a set of consumers for a fixed period of time.
The Treasury Department says this will free up companies to experiment with things like artificial intelligence and blockchain technology without potentially landing them in regulatory trouble. Of course, experiments can fail, and then consumers are the ones in trouble. Tarkowski again.
They would know up front that this is something new, and a consumer can make the decision for themselves on whether or not it's a transaction that they'd like to engage in.
But some consumer advocates point out that finance is complicated, and some customers won't fully grasp what they're risking. Scott Estrada is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
Those consumers that would be harmed by potential bad actors or bad policies, even though their intent is not bad, would have lifelong repercussions.
While each sandbox might look different, Estrada says some of the regulations pushed to the side could include those designed to protect consumers' data privacy or limit discrimination in lending. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the Trump administration, there was healthcare news. Today, the White House finalized some rules that expand access to what are called short-term health insurance plans. Coverage, basically, that you can get when you have a temporary gap in your health insurance, like if you lose your job. You might have heard them referred to as skinny plans because they are often cheap, but they also tend to be thin on benefits. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
I wanted to know what exactly a short-term health insurance plan might cover. So I Googled it and found one for someone who matches my description. 29 years old, not a smoker. It costs about $30 a month. But a lot of things aren't covered, like prescription drugs, maternity care. Oh, and if I already had a medical condition, say allergies, that wouldn't be covered either. Christine Eibner is a senior economist at the Rand Corporation.
They can deny coverage or charge higher premiums to those with pre-existing conditions.
Most healthcare plans don't allow these kinds of terms because of the Affordable Care Act. But the Obama administration made an exception for short-term health plans. If you were in transition, like if you lost your job, you could buy a plan like this for up to 3 months. Now, the Trump administration will let insurers offer you a short-term plan for up to 3 years. Ashley Swanson teaches healthcare management at the Wharton School.
I think the Trump administration's argument is that this is allowing a new option to enter the market that is very affordable and that some people will like.
The problem, she says, is that consumers may not realize exactly what they're getting, especially because illness is often unexpected. Another concern about these new rules, Vivian Ho from Rice University says if enough healthy people trade their Affordable Care Act plans for skimpy short-term insurance, that could destabilize the ACA's health insurance pools, leaving only the sickest people.
You have higher risk people with chronic diseases in those plans, and the premiums then go up.
And that'll really hurt the people who don't get subsidies to cover their health insurance. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Two quick corporate stock updates before we move on. Item one, Tesla. The company reported profits after the bell today. I should say much-watched profits. Wasn't good news, though. Revenue was up, which is a positive, but CEO Elon Musk and the gang lost $700 million the past 3 months trying to get that Model 3 line up and running. Item two, Apple. First of all, the ticker is AAPL, not the thing I said yesterday. Thanks for pointing that out to everybody. Also, shares closed today at $201.50 a piece, about $2 shy of where it needs to be to make Apple a trillion-dollar publicly traded company. The major indices at the corner of Wall Street and Broad were mixed on this Wednesday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In the ongoing saga of American technology companies doing business overseas and the pitfalls that can lie beyond the American market, we present to you, and not for the first time, Google and a report first made in The Intercept today, later in The New York Times, that Google is creating a modified search engine specifically for the Chinese market, one that would filter certain terms like dissidents and anti-communism. We called Google for a comment and or to talk to CEO Sundar Pichai about this and a bunch of other stuff. The company said, and this is a quote, they don't comment on speculation about future plans. We, however, still do have some questions. So we got Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the line to make us smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So setting aside the, this doesn't look great factor, which we'll get to in a second. Would this make good business sense for Google?
I mean, on the face of it, of course it does, just like it has made good business sense or appeared to, wishfully, for so many companies, because there are billions of potential users there. And although Alphabet continues to report strong earnings, the company is starting to diversify away from only advertising as its major revenue driver. The fact is that advertising still is the major source of revenue, and it's slowing. That growth has slowed. And Amazon's ad business is just getting off the ground. Amazon is the number one place people search for products online. Facebook is still a huge competitor in the ad world. So to continue to diversify and ensure dominance, China does seem like an obvious bet.
Right. Alphabet, of course, the parent company of Google. So let me ask you about that obvious bet question, right? Because now we get to the thing I started with, which is the, this doesn't look great factor. Discuss.
Right. There is definitely the bad PR factor, and that is significant. But there's also the fact that doing business in China is like the all too literal version of getting involved in a land war in Asia, to quote The Princess Bride.
Inconceivable.
You know, exactly. It is expensive. It is political. It involves a lot of compromises. And the Chinese government is going to prioritize the home team. And so Yahoo, for example, is a cautionary tale from the late 90s and early 2000s, spent billions trying to grow its business in China, got embroiled in cultural issues, couldn't attract users, cooperated with the Chinese government to turn over information on dissidents who were jailed for a decade. As a result, in that bad PR haunted Yahoo for the entire decade. It ended up laying off 300 people and investing $1 billion in Chinese homegrown company Alibaba.
That's right. Can I ask you the slippery slope question here, which goes something like this? And I'm not insinuating in any way, and let's be clear about this, that Google would apply these filters to searches done outside of China. But social media platforms and technology platforms getting into the business of censoring. You and I have discussed this many times on this program and also on our podcast, Make Me Smart. How much of that is going on here?
Yeah, there is a reason that internet platforms have long resisted, pretty much always firmly resisted, creating any sophisticated filtering and censoring technology, because once it exists, everybody's going to want it. You know, for years, Google and Twitter and Reddit, you can claim so much immunity from liability because Google, for example, could say, look, I can't filter content. The way this works is you have to ask to have things taken down and Google can comply. Well, you can bet the U.S. government would really want tech that could filter out potentially terrorist speech. You can bet that people who want to publish 3D printed gun blueprints would be happy to sue Google for filtering out that speech. And you can definitely bet that copyright holders have just been waiting for the day that Google would slip up and admit, you know, that it could have prevented copyrighted material from showing up in searches and on YouTube, but chose not to. It's a very, it's like the summer slip and slide.
Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech and also with me on our podcast, Make Me Smart. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Guy.
See ya. Largely lost in the shuffle of who is imposing which tariffs on whom, because come on, they've been flying back and forth pretty willy-nilly the past 4 or 5 months, has been this fact. The president's steel and aluminum duties were aimed at strategic rivals, yes, like China, also allies, Mexico, Canada, and the European Union, but at least they got deferments on those tariffs for a month. But Japanese steel imports to the United States, a lot of it highly specialized, have been subjected to a 25% tariff from the very beginning. And that is not helping at all as the world's second largest steel producer, which Japan is trying to find its way through long-term economic change. Adrian Ma went to see how that is playing out where Japanese steel was born.
Japan's first modern blast furnace was built in 1857 in a city called Kamaishi. And the best way to get there is on the steel tracks of a passenger train. From Tokyo, it's a six-hour ride up into the mountains, then down towards the coast. When you get off at Kamaishi Station, the first thing you see walking out is a giant green manufacturing plant. On the side, it says Nippon Steel in big black letters.
Watch out, if you both your hands are held up, make sure you don't trip and fall.
That's plant manager Masaki Hino speaking through a translator. He didn't really want to talk about tariffs, but he was pretty eager to show me how automated the plant is. Today, about 300 people work there. But back in the 60s, the number of employees was almost 30 times that. As I learned watching an animated film in the city's Iron and Steel Museum, the industry once employed about 10% of the population. In Japan, they call company towns like this castle towns. Ikumi Kawahata is a local historian.
When I was growing up in elementary school, I was living right by the plant, so I could see all the chimneys.
Life was good. The city was bustling, and sure, there was a bit of air pollution, but if you wanted to get clean, you could always go to the public baths, operated by Nippon Steel. But then, in the 1980s, the company restructured, moving many of its operations away from Kamaishi. Kawahata remembers watching as the chimneys from the old blast furnaces were torn down.
It made me feel sad because I thought, we're no longer the city of steel.
In the years that followed, Kamaishi lost about two-thirds of its population. And Hisetada Maruki, who heads up the nonprofit Kamaishi Social Welfare Council, says the city lost a big piece of its identity.
When they left, that was the first time I realized that we didn't create the city. Nippon Steel created it.
He says Kamaishi has tried to forge a new identity around industries like seafood processing and machine parts. But then in 2011, Kamaishi suffered a major setback. A magnitude 9 earthquake caused a tsunami to rip through the city. Today, there is still a lot of rebuilding happening, but most of downtown has been revived. New apartments and a new shopping mall sit on land that used to be occupied by Nippon Steel. On the surface, things are looking up. But at a fish market down the road, Eiko Murakami says she's anxious about the future.
Everything looks brand new and well-constructed, but that's just the outward appearance.
The city's declining population means fewer customers, she says. And that probably won't change unless more young people decide to stay. At a nearby community center, 16-year-old Ino Hasagawa and her friends are just finishing up a dance class. She says it's comfortable here. You can live a normal life.
Do you think you'll stick around?
I would definitely have to leave for my education, because there's no college here.
But after that, Hasagawa says she doesn't know. One of the great things about this town, she says, is that even as it changes, the people stay the same. She's just not sure she'll be one of them. In Kamaishi, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace. Coming up.
I have a passion for movies because I love movies.
Passion don't always make a business model, though, does it? First, though, let's do the numbers. Well, welcome to August, gang. Dow Industrial's off 0.3%, 81 points, 25,333. The NASDAQ picked up 0.4%, about 35 points, 7,707. The S&P 500 gave back 0.1%, 2 points, 28.13. We told you about the Fed's view of things. Financial firms took those words to the bank. Bank of America clicked up 0.1%. JPMorgan Chase deposited 0.6%, ditto for Wells Fargo. Tesla, we told you about, shares revved up more than 4% after hours. While we're on cars, Ferrari shifted into low gear today, reversing 11% after its new CEO called financial targets aspirational. Here's what I don't understand about that. Isn't Ferrari as a company aspirational, right? You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from John in Austin, Texas, not too long ago, who says he and his wife think Marketplace is the most informative and creative radio program in America, which is nice to hear. If you agree with John, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to John and everybody who makes our work possible.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're the kind of sports fan who likes to put a little money down on games, there is some news for you this week. The National Basketball Association has become the first major sports league in this country to sign a deal with a sports betting operation. Back in May, you might remember, the Supreme Court said it was okay for states to legalize sports betting, meaning Las Vegas would no longer have a monopoly. ESPN reports the deal the NBA signed with MGM Resorts is worth $25 million over 3 years. Marketplace's Jed Kim looks at what each side might stand to gain.
Why the deal? First, let's talk money.
This isn't about money.
Okay, fine, not about money. Greg Bettinelli is a partner at Upfront Ventures. He's invested in some fantasy sports betting startups.
This is about an open for business sign, and the NBA is going to be proactive here.
Legalized sports gambling is the future, and the NBA and WNBA are staking their claims. Michael McCann teaches sports law at the University of New Hampshire. He says this deal puts the NBA in a better position to demand a cut of future wagers. Even if that doesn't happen, the tie-up with MGM is pretty low stakes.
It's not a cost for the league. This is a way of generating attention that doesn't require, as far as we can tell, real expenditure.
Until recently, sports leagues stayed far away from gambling. Now, MGM gets to borrow the NBA brand. Brendan Dwyer researches sports and behavior at Virginia Commonwealth University.
It gives MGM really some credibility to their gaming that when they start, you know, operating in states that allow sports betting, having the NBA's logo is really going to help.
The real value, though, is the official data stream from the NBA. Gamblers may soon be able to make bets during games on things like how many threes Steph Curry is going to drain in the fourth. Sarah Slane is with the American Gaming Association.
It creates a whole new vertical for the sports industry and the casino industry.
The deal is not exclusive to MGM Resorts, so there's a good chance this is just the first we'll see between sports bookmakers and the NBA. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
One of the losingest stocks on Wall Street today was a company called Helios and Matheson Analytics. HMNY is the ticker, down 54%, which sounds like a lot, and it is, except the share price of the parent company of the subscription service MoviePass went from 50 cents
$2.23. So there's that. MoviePass, as you might have heard, has been having all kinds of problems lately, mostly because even though it just raised prices for its users, now it's $12.95 a month for as many movies as you want to go to, the company still has to pay full freight to movie chains every time you walk in the door, which is, in a strictly business sense, an opportunity for competition. That competition is here, and it's called Cinemia. It's got more realistic pricing, shall we say. It's now in the American market from its roots in Turkey and Europe. And Cinemia is today's installment of Corner Office. Rifat Oguz is the founder and CEO. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So if I say movie ticket subscription service to people out there on Figueroa Street outside our studios, they're going to say MoviePass. Does that make you crazy?
Well, back then, yes.
Right.
Maybe like 6 months ago or a year ago. But almost one and a half year ago, no one actually the movie subscription.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, and I was doing this business like 4 years.
Yeah, so we should say you started it in Turkey, right?
You brought it over here in Europe.
You brought it over here because you have to be in the American movie market. Is that the deal?
I think this is the capital of movies. Hollywood drives the movie market, yeah. And we need to be in this market.
So I want to get to the business side of this in a minute, but since you brought up Hollywood and the movie market, the movie business and the movie market is changing now, right? We're doing a whole lot of big tentpole movies. It's all brands and franchises, and you get a couple of biggies a year, and maybe not so many sort of artsy or independent films that don't always get all the buzz. What does that do to your business, right? How does that affect how you go selling these passes?
Well, it brings me back to why I actually found Cinemia.
Yeah.
Because 4 years ago, I was working for a corporate world. I was working for payment cards and the banks. Yeah. Then the passion for movies, because I love movies. So why don't we have a subscription so we don't actually limit ourselves, because right now we just go to see this big franchise like the Avengers or
right.
But we don't have a subscription.
The deal with subscriptions though is that it's got to make it cheaper for me than I think I paid $17 a ticket to go see whatever the last one I saw was, right? Which is nuts. So make it worth my while, right? So, give me the pitch.
So if it is subscription, we create a bigger economy, and we can expect the demand.
Right.
So I figured out that from my background, I was dealing with payment cards, and
which is fundamentally kind of what this is, right? Yeah. It's kind of a payment card.
I always tell people, like, we are not in the movie ticketing business; we are in the financial technology business.
takes a little bit of the romance out of going to the movies, though.
Well, that's true, but
but that's okay because it's actually a business.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you look at MoviePass, which is for now the industry leader, right, and the trouble it's having, right? It's having some really serious issues. Do you get worried, or do you think that's an opportunity for you?
Well, I always see this like everything is an opportunity side. About a year ago, after our move to LA,
yep.
They dropped their price to $9.99.
Yeah, they did.
All the investors asked me, like, going to do the same. And
your investors said to you, you're going to drop your price as well?
Yeah.
Because that's money out of their pocket, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. We will keep what we are doing, because this is how we succeed, right? So we keep $9.99 for two movie tickets, but we give more flexible options. So the casual moviegoers, like the competitors, are saying that later they will go less than a month, right?
Because right, less than once a month.
So if you're really going less than a month, we thought that you don't need an unlimited option.
One of the critiques of this company has been that its user experience is not necessarily great, some issues with the apps. How much of your time do you spend, now that you've got it up and running, how much of your time do you spend troubleshooting, and how do you fix that? Because once a consumer gets turned off, it's kind of tricky, right, to get them back.
Well, that's true. And we know that we're improving our apps every day, right? But one thing that we do in Cinemia, we have 60 people in our team. Mm-hmm. And from the IT, the marketing, the customer experience to finance, they all see all the like negative social media like reports every day when it happens. So then everybody knows what the issue is, and they're working to improve that. So that's one thing that we do every day.
How often do you go to the movies?
Right now, I go once a week.
Really?
Yeah. We need to be in the movie theater. We need to feel the audience.
Rifato Guz, he's the CEO and founder of Cinemia. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
There is more to talk about on this. Obviously, subscription models being part of the wave of the economic future as they are. What, for instance, is Cinemia going to do about movie chains offering their own subscriptions? We've got the whole interview on our Corner Office podcast. Check it out. This final note on the way out today, who's leaking what on trade to whom from Inside the White House edition. Remember we told you yesterday about reports the Treasury Department is having conversations with China about stepping back from the trade war brink? Yeah, well, belay my last. In a call with reporters this afternoon, the White House said actually what's going on is that the president has directed the U.S. trade representative not only to not step back, but in fact to look into raising American tariffs on a couple of $100 million worth of Chinese imports to the United States from 10% to 25%. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 0.3% today, 81 points. NASDAQ picked up 0.4%, about 35 points. S&P 500 gave back a tenth. That is 2 points there. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.